live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo. All upper fire panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Adam Angievsky, George Cardenas, Michael Lotus, Dave Lundy, and Roger Stone. Our program tonight coming to our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email me a comment, it's Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. If you want to tweet me a comment, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. And, of course, you can join us on the World Wide Web, audio and video every night, or every week, rather, actually every night, because it's there constantly, at beyondthebeltway.com. Tomorrow marks the 1 month of Donald Trump as president of the United States. There's been a lot of actions. We have one of our focuses a little bit later on in the broadcast is we're going to talk about the very controversial subject of sanctuary cities. And later in the broadcast, we're going to be joined by one of Donald Trump's best friends and longtime political advisor, Roger Stone, who's written a new book called The Making of the President 2016. So you'll want to stay for the full 2 hours this evening. Let's begin. Dave Lundy, I want to talk to you. Because you are a card-carrying Democrat, you are a vociferous critic of the president. I don't think I've ever heard you say anything nice about him. 30 days, he had a big rally yesterday. Is there anything wrong with the president returning to his home base to get a little loving after 30 days of being beaten up by the media? Anything wrong with it?
Other than that, it speaks to an insatiable ego that can never be quenched. And so after having a press conference in which he repeatedly lied to the American people and attacked the press and then tweeted out that the press is an enemy of the people, he tweeted, for those who didn't hear, that the press is an enemy of the people. He felt it was important for him to go down and have a cheering throng of 9,000 people. Bruce, this is, you know, I'm tired of saying the word unprecedented. I've decided I need a new vocabulary for this president. But I'm not sure what public purpose it serves. I also, by the way, would kind of like to know who's paying for all the Air Force One back and forth to
Mar-a-Lago.
Let's
ask Michael Lotus, who's our card-carrying Trumpster. You were for Trump before it was fashionable, was fashionable in this city.
I don't think it is. Not here, that's for sure.
answer the question. Was he there to pump his ego after being roughed up for 30 days by the media in D.C.?
It's a fool's errand to try to read Donald Trump's mind remotely. I will say that presidents giving speeches to adoring throngs of supporters is something that happens all the time. Franklin Roosevelt would from time to time go on tour and talk to the faithful, so it's not that unusual a thing. He's certainly gotten beat up pretty hard in the last 30 days. He's accomplished a lot. He's kept a lot of his promises. He's made a lot of his supporters happy, and he's irritated the people who you'd expect wouldn't like what he does.
George Cardenas also joins us. He is a longtime alderman of the city of Chicago. George, nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
The first 30 days, there's been a lot of demonstrations in the street. A lot of in the Hispanic community are very upset with him because of his crackdown, his pledge to build the wall, a lot of other issues. Do you see any possibility that the president could do something that would make Hispanics think twice about him in any positive way? Or is that just – is that a vote? Is that a constituency that he just is never, ever going to have?
I don't think so. I think that – obviously, he's you know, treating himself like an apprentice in the White House. I think his policies, he's doing what he said he was going to do. But the way he's executing that – it's not very well for him. He could do for the Dreamers, though. He says he likes kids. He has a great family, and he adores his children. And I think he could act presidential and say, look, these are the kids that I think I want to protect. These are the kids that I think have a future in this country. They're not criminals.
But hasn't he issued a little possibility that he might be wavering on that pledge during the campaign?
But why not act? Why not?
Because he was criticized on the Sunday morning shows today for that. That's one of the promises that he may be breaking to his core supporters is that he may be softening.
Well, you said that there's an opening. That's an opening.
Okay.
That's an opening that definitely could act on the Dreamers and say, look, I think that we've invested in these kids. They're in this country. They don't know anything else. It wasn't their fault. Let's do something now. And that that would give the Hispanics, some reprieve in saying, look, this guy is crazy, but maybe we can work with this guy.
Adam Andrzejewski also makes his first appearance. Adam, nice to have you with us. OpenTheBooks.com. We'll talk about fiscal matters as the program unfolds this evening. What's your reaction to the first 30 days? Is he doing things that he absolutely has to do because he feels he still has to firm up his base after all this?
Well, I don't think he has to firm up his base. I think what we have seen, especially over the first 24 days, was action. So he executed exactly on what he ran on and the agenda that he was elected on. And it was 24 executive orders. It was 4 foreign leaders in the White House. It was executing on many of the major policies that he's told all of us that he was going to do, and then he did it. And I think that's what that's why he's out there talking to his base again, because he doesn't trust the media to get that narrative out to his supporters.
Dave, what about that? He's delivered on many of his major issues already.
Well, I just want to go back to one quick point that Michael said. You're absolutely right. Franklin Roosevelt did go out and speak to people, and presidents do that. Usually they're going out in support of a specific policy agenda, so a specific initiative. So President Obama, when he was trying to get health care passed, he would go out and try to sell health care. What was unusual about this one is that, A, it's 30 days into his administration, so I'm not sure exactly what exactly he's going out to try to sell. B, there wasn't really a unifying message other than that the press is evil and that the judiciary is problematic.
But doesn't his base want to hear that?
Sure, he could go out there on a daily basis and his base would eat it up. But that's not the point of being president.
If you can look at press coverage in an objective way,
yes.
Is there anything that you have seen thus far that you would be able to say, you know what, that might have been a little over the top in the way the media has covered the president?
You know, I am a little uncomfortable when I see reporters' Twitter feeds that are way too snarky. When you have a mainstream reporter for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the way that they're tweeting about the president is very snarky, you're calling him a liar or things like that. I think that's inappropriate. I think the investigations of Russia are 100% appropriate and led to General Flynn stepping down as national security advisor, who should never have been national security advisor.
Do the leaks bother you?
Yeah, the leaks bother me because they're crimes. And the only way you get the information that's in that those telephone calls was subject to a warrant issued by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. It's a crime to disclose that. The investigation
we couldn't. Some of the leaks have come from the White House itself, somewhere in the White House.
You know, I have seen things that suggest the only source these could have come from would have been in the Obama White House. I don't know, but I would like a full-scale investigation of that because it's criminal behavior. I'd also like, to be fair, everything Flynn said, I'd like to see the warrant, I'd like to see the transcript, put it on the table, let the American people see what he did.
And look, the reason I think that that Trump's in South Carolina and Florida so early is because the mainstream media will not cover what his agenda is. His agenda is all about jobs. It's about an ascendant America. It's about putting America first, you know, with possibly $1 trillion of infrastructure spending during a period when around the world there's a zero interest rate environment. Now's the time to build. This is the Trump agenda, right? And so the media, all they're concerned about are these shiny baubles that get hung out there that they glob onto, and they're not paying attention to what the central core message of this administration is, and that's to build America first.
So where's the infrastructure plan?
And also the relationship, the alleged relationship between the Trump administration and Russia, which is a carryover of the campaign of Hillary Clinton.
You don't know what to believe.
Back shortly from Chicago.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
Thank you all very much, Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans. Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Most of my family, they never graduated high school, so I'm trying to break that barrier.
My daughter Brooklyn was also a motivation for me to go back to school.
Every day after work, went straight to school, and it paid off.
At age 26, Kareem finished his high school diploma.
I could not have done it alone. I see the future is really bright for me.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. George, let me ask you a question. One of the issues that the president is dealing with is whether he has an alleged war going on with the intelligence community. He says that he's getting along fine with them, but there are stories in the New York Times and other publications suggesting that there's people in the intelligence agency that really don't like him. Obviously, the outgoing comments by John Brennan were disrespectful to the president because Brennan thought the president was disrespectful to members of the CIA.
Publicly bashing.
So here's my question to you. Who do you believe? Because when any president, when you go into office, aren't you totally you're being molded by the intelligence that you get.
Right.
If you don't believe that intelligence, or you think historically that intelligence has been faulty, would you trust them? I mean, it seems to me that the intelligence community and those that support them, mostly all the major media, it's like you're supposed to give blind allegiance to the CIA and American intelligence.
I don't think I don't think that's the case. I think he initially, from the get-go, even before he was sworn in as president, he did not want any intelligence briefings whatsoever. I think publicly
because he didn't trust them.
Well, but why not? Well, he doesn't know that. He doesn't know the data. He doesn't know the intelligence that is being put before him. So why criticize an intelligence community at that point? When he hasn't developed that relationship.
Because at one point he said, and I don't know exactly what, but it was during the campaign. It wasn't after he was elected. At one point during the campaign, he made some comment about, well, you know, this is what the intelligence community said. This is the same intelligence community that said there were weapons of mass destruction. Now, I've heard Democrats say that for years, Dave. What's wrong with questioning the intelligence community if there are examples of where the intelligence community did not do well, including leading up to 9/11, there were agency deficiencies. So
well,
why believe them all?
First of all, there's a lot of conflating going on here, and Donald Trump in that comment conflated as well, because you'll recall, leading up to the Iraq War, the intelligence was cherry-picked. And Cheney and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and Feith were pushing away any intelligence that contradicted the narrative that they were trying to promote. This has been well documented again and again, and Colin Powell talked about this not too long ago. Yes, absolutely, after the fact. It's not so much that the CIA said that there were weapons of mass destruction as much as there was very selective channeling. And by the way, this is one of the problems here. The president should question the intelligence community privately. Right. He should have conversations with the intelligence community saying, wait, is this correct? He should question the military privately. Before the bin Laden raid, Barack Obama insisted upon an extra helicopter just in case there was a breakdown. And it turned out he was prophetic and he was right. And it was a good move. So nobody is saying you shouldn't question intelligence community. You're saying you shouldn't mock the intelligence community. The intelligence community is saying right now, yeah, we don't like to be mocked.
When was he mocked? Give me an example of mocking in your view.
Of the intelligence community?
Yeah.
I think that his entire tone and the tenor right up until the moment he went and spoke to the CIA, there was story after story. I'd have to pull up the quotes, but there were lots of quotes out
there. Flynn, I think the Flynn case, I think General Flynn, obviously yeah. He was dismissed, but certainly that provided an opportunity for the President Trump to say something about the intelligence community and saying, look, to be unfair to this guy. Completely unfair, which wasn't the case. I mean, there's obviously something there.
No. But he did say he was critical of the leaks, that there were leaks coming from the intelligence community. That's basically from this week.
That's a serious problem.
It is a serious problem. In the Flynn case, for example, for one thing,
he's 2% of the time into his presidency. If he is a one-term president, he's got 98% yet to go. I don't even know if all of his – I don't think all of his personnel to even head the intelligence departments are in place yet. And I know he hasn't staffed them. There's 4,000 positions that need to be staffed, and I don't think they've got any of them filled yet. So when he has his own people in and can start to direct the activities of the intelligence community, we may see some change. On this Flynn thing where there was a leak – of information that must have been obtained pursuant to a wiretap warrant. That's a crime. It's very serious, and that kind of thing has to stop, and that should be investigated. And it should be not
and,
so much.
And in your view, did the information about the conversation and the wiretaps by the FBI, could that have only come from the intelligence community?
My understanding is that information can only have been obtained pursuant to a wiretap of Flynn's communications, which you get from a warrant that's issued by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. There's no other place it could have come from.
Adam,
Senator editorial in the Wall Street Journal during this crisis said the exact same thing that that Mike Lotus just said, that if a private citizen, Flynn, was taped, that can only come from a FISA judge. And if that's the case, we need to know and have that entire case opened up. And that's transparency. That should be done. We need to know if a private American citizen was being taped.
But the ambassador was being taped.
Exactly.
The ambassador, the Russian ambassador, he's a diplomat.
But they shield the private citizen.
For all we know, he could be a spy.
That's policy. They shield the private citizen
They get taped. There's surveillance on them all the time. He was caught in a surveillance
with the Russian ambassador. Can you answer Adam's point? I agree with you. I think factually you're right.
Right.
But speak to Adam's point.
Right. So the policy is, as according to the Wall Street Journal, is that the private American citizen, which Michael Flynn was, is shielded on those taps. We may be tapping the Russian, but the American is always shielded, but not
but
in this
by,
case.
But by default, he happens to be in a conversation with the Russian ambassador. He's not being targeted, but if he's in a conversation with the ambassador,
it's lawful to surveil that conversation. It's not to disclose it to a newspaper.
Gentlemen, right. I want to ask you a broader question against sticking with the subject of intelligence. It has been suggested, in fact, Rush Limbaugh was the one that first broke this and was on the news Chris Wallace today. And that is, there is a substantial number of people still left in the government, certainly in the intelligence community, who don't like Donald Trump, didn't vote for him, might have been, Hillary Clinton. There's a political element there, and that these people are bureaucrats, they are civil service, they're still in place, and they are going to do things that are going to make the president or this administration look bad. Is there some truth to that possibility, Dave?
Well, you just said two things that are somewhat contradictory, because they're not Obama administration political appointees if they're civil servants.
Some are. A little bit of both.
But my point is that, look, the leaking that is going on in this administration is unprecedented in terms of the level and certainly the timing. I mean, you look at some of these stories, and Ryan Priebus was on the various shows today saying, oh, these stories are nonsense because they don't name sources. Well, newsflash, neither did any of the sources in Watergate until the very end. But the stories go out of their way to say there were 9 sources for this story. And the volume of the leaks, it's telling you something. I mean, look, you deal with whistleblowers. Mm-hmm. You work hard with whistleblowers. Whistleblowers are there to say this is wrong. Now, is it legal what some of these people were doing? Probably not. Do you want to know if the incoming national security advisor is having conversations that, first of all, are not what anybody is saying, second of all, are negotiating with the Russians on the very same day mm-hmm. that Obama imposed sanctions?
And the FBI said there was no problem with it.
The FBI said
there was no problem with it. It was leaked because it was, I don't know why, to put pressure on Trump
Flynn
or something.
Flynn got fired because he lied to the vice president, not because he broke the law.
We're not talking about the real issue.
In the intelligence community, in my view, presidents come and presidents go. And I said on Facebook, you and I disagreed on a Facebook post this past week, I saw some similarities to Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon was not a good guy. He did things that literally should have forced him out of office. But when you look at the history of Watergate and how that story unfolded, every time during that whole saga, which lasted a couple of years, every time it looked like the Nixon administration was sort of weathering the political storm, there would be some other story that would pop from an unnamed source, many of which came from the intelligence community, and it was this drip, drip, drip that ultimately got Richard Nixon, because there were people on the inside that wanted to get rid of Richard Nixon. Because at that particular time, remember, Richard Nixon was making friends with the Chinese. He had detente with the Soviet Union. There was all kinds of things that Richard Nixon was trying to do on the world stage that the CIA didn't want. So I'm not saying that Richard Nixon wasn't ultimately forced out of office for maybe the right reasons, but there was a lot of encouragement from American intelligence agencies to get rid of Richard Nixon.
Well, we don't know what the relationship is.
And I draw a comparison.
Correct.
With Donald
and
Trump,
that's a good
because
one.
Because Donald Trump now he wants to make nice with the Russians.
Well, but then, and that is really the issue we should be talking about.
Right.
With the Russian relationship, how deep it goes, and why is this whole fascination with Russia all of a sudden from Trump's side, and a lot of folks that are in his administration.
The fascination.
Russians have been our enemy. For since the Cold War, I mean, at the beginning of the Cold War, all of a sudden we're warming up to this, not even a giant of a power, not even a power, global power anymore, that is taking over Crimea, that is infringing on other rights, that is infringing on our democracy.
And what did Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton do on their watch? Crimea, when that happened, Barack Obama was the president of the United States. Now, sanctions were imposed. What else was done?
The sanctions were very harmful to the Russians, and they were pretty effective. They cut Russian GNP way down. What has Trump actually done, though? The one thing he's done is he's pushing the NATO allies to spend more money on their defense. The Russians can't match that. Mattis went over there, and he's a NATO guy. He used to be one of the NATO senior guys. He's a friend talking to them, and he said, if you don't raise your spending, we're going to have to moderate our support. From a guy like him, that's a huge threat. The Russians can't match that if
a lot of brass, including the vice president of the United States, over there to talk security with Munich. And who got the headline? John McCain. Back shortly to about the senator when we continue on Beyond the Beltway. Don't go away.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair. See Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
The biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv. To the office. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. I mentioned that John McCain was over in Munich, and with his speech, he kind of stole the show, suggesting that the West was in deep trouble if they didn't dramatically change the way they operate, and warned our NATO allies, and also made some comments about Donald Trump and suggesting that authoritarianism may be on the horizon. It's one of the first things that happens when a dictator goes after a free press. And got a lot of press on that, was on most of the Sunday shows today. Michael Lotus, what should the Republican Party and how should Donald Trump handle John McCain?
John McCain is an old guy. He's always been the way he is. I think you just respect his service and let him talk and don't try to do anything. What are you going to do with John McCain? He's not going to change his ways. As far as saying that what Trump is doing is like what a dictator does, I don't see it. I think most people don't see it.
What do you think, Adam?
Well, one of the things about Donald Trump is that the Fourth Estate is not going to be forthright anymore. You're going to see journalists actually do their job and hold politicians accountable. And at OpenTheBooks.com, we applaud that. Now, Trump won because he was the only candidate in both political parties through the primaries into the general election that was like Moses. He brought his people home. And so that's why you see him out there in South Carolina and Florida. He's again delivering the message to the people. He's bringing that base back together.
One of the issues that he talked about during the campaign, he's also now acted on it as president of the United States, and that is sanctuary cities. Most people didn't know what sanctuary cities were. Their cities, basically, whose law enforcement agencies have not cooperated with INS or any of the efforts by the federal government to crack down on deportation and people in the country illegally. That's the 50-cent analysis of that. You've looked at sanctuary cities because sanctuary cities is one of the things, it's one of the promises. I think he got a lot of votes because of that issue. And it's one of the issues that he says he wants to do something about, which basically with withhold federal funding from cities that don't cooperate in the enforcement of our immigration laws. Tell us a little bit, how widespread is that? How many cities and municipalities are we talking about when we talk about sanctuary cities, Adam? Because you've done research on it.
So across the country, there's roughly 300 jurisdictions. Most of them are either states, counties, townships, but there's 106 self-described sanctuary cities. So what is the definition of a sanctuary city? And really, what we used to compile our report was the Department of Justice definition, which is simply a reporting requirement. If a local police department picks up what they call under the law in a Obama Justice Department memo, aliens in custody, the failure to report that person to federal authorities by a police department sets up the sanctuary city argument. So after January 25th, when the president issued his executive order to cut federal funding from sanctuary cities, the big question is, what's at stake? What is the amount of federal funding at stake? And all the biggest newsrooms in the country tried to dig into it. They were unsuccessful. At openthebooks.com, our auditors did that. We're holding all federal funding, and the number is $27 billion into the 106 cities.
I want you to follow up on that, but I want to get George Cardenas an opportunity. He's an alderman in the city of Chicago. The first part of that definition that Adam just put on the table, should a local municipality and a police department, should they cooperate with federal authorities who are trying to enforce federal laws? Yes or no?
Look, it's not our priority. It shouldn't be a priority of the police department to be an immigration force or crack down, whatever you want to call it. I think the priority of a local police is to police, protect people in their communities, and create an environment where people are going to be helpful to combat crime.
How can a police department violate federal law?
It's not violating federal law. It just says, look, I'm not going to be your puppet for enforcing immigration laws. That's your job. My job is to work with communities to be able to fight crime locally, which matters to us.
Which federal agency would you like to see working in the city of Chicago, enforcing that law, if you don't want the Chicago Police Department?
They are here. They're enforcing ICE. ICE is here. ICE has detainers. There are Cook County. There's ICE officers in the county.
Okay,
one of the different things here that I say different is because the application of the rule is to not pull detainers on people that have been arrested for whatever reason. And without that hold, the ICE officers may miss the timing when this person is released, and therefore deportable. If the person is deportable, then they miss that opportunity. But police officers, stopping somebody for a traffic violation or stopping somebody because they think they're being flagged for whatever reason, and then asking them about their immigration status, I think it's a no-no.
No, these are, quote, aliens in custody. So there's somebody that's actually in the jail. There's a federal law that the Obama Justice Department issued a memo in July of last year during the summer that said there is a reporting requirement of that police department to simply notify federal authorities. That's what's at stake, and that's what Mayor Rahm Emanuel and the other 106 mayors across the country, they are saying they're not going to comply with federal law. Now, Bruce, if you violate as an individual federal law, rightly so, the full power of the federal government will force you into compliance. So what we're talking about here is a major issue of the rule of law in this country. Can a public body, can government like Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago, willfully and publicly say he is not going to follow federal law?
Dave Lundy, I think he's got to follow it. What do you think? Where do you come down on this?
Well, I don't actually think that's what the mayor is saying. What I've heard, and I am not an expert on this issue, so I'd say that outright. But what I've heard when hearing, listening to police forces talk about this, including police forces in southern states, is that there's a great deal of anxiety that they will alienate the local police's number one job is to protect the community from crime and from violent crime, not from the federal immigration enforcement, and that they are concerned about alienating those community and shutting off both their sources of information and shutting off the interest. You know, if somebody's
but
having
if
a crime.
Some of the perpetrators of crime are illegal immigrants. Shouldn't that shouldn't you go where the crimes go?
Sure, but less
they are deported. Look,
but they're not being noticed. That's the whole debate.
If you look at the process, I think the process is working. And Obama deported 2 million immigrants from this country, so there's a process in place.
Right.
This president is setting a different tone when it comes to his approach to immigration policy, and that is says, look, be damned the process. I want, and just not on the borders, so if you're coming in, I want it to apply. If you've been here before and you left the country willingly, I'm not going to let you come back. And there's many facets that he's applying that is being effective from that standpoint. But what's different here, if you come to communities, he deported about 100 people in the last raids that they did, 800 people. The chaos that he created in the entire country is not worth that effort. There's 11 million potential undocumented people in this country. If you break it down, if he was to do that every day for, you know, since his I guess from his elected time in office, it would take 37 years.
But he's
if
he
was
okay.
to do
but
it every
said
single
that's not what
day,
he's trying to do. Michael,
if he was to do it every single day, 37 years.
I like Dave. I'm going to confess this. This is a law-bound area. I'm not an expert. It seems if what Adam says is right, and they're supposed to report people in custody who are not in the country legally, and that's a federal law, they should follow the federal law. Beyond that, I don't
know. So furthermore, I mean, these mayors, these sheriffs, now these governors.
Austin, Texas is a sanctuary city.
They are local nullifiers of federal law, and that's a constitutional crisis. Mayor Rahm Emanuel says he's not going to follow this law of notice when he has an alien in custody because he wants to be a welcoming city. That is not a constitutional argument. He needs to follow the law.
And every other big city Democratic mayor basically has followed the same thing. De Blasio said the same thing. Los Angeles, San Francisco, you know, the sheriff in Austin.
So there has to be a penalty.
Well, we're not going to dedicate resources.
We have to have a penalty.
We're not going to dedicate resources
either through Congress or the president.
Well,
we're not going to dedicate resources in this city.
We broke it down on a per capita basis.
On an immigration system that is broken. We're not going to divert resources that we need for fighting real crime.
Alderman, honestly,
800 murders last year.
Of resources.
How hard is it to ask someone in custody or to check with whatever records they have to make a determination about them, compile that, and periodically report it? How hard is that? No, really, I'm not trying to be.
Look,
I want to know.
If it's a criminal, I don't disagree with you. If it's somebody that couldn't post bond because they didn't have the money, and it's somebody that was working hard, got stopped because he was driving on his way to work, or was a taillight that was broken, minor offenses, and I question the effort, to be honest with you.
Well, that's a different question because you said it would be too hard. So, I mean, is it really hard
because,
to just...
Because you can't... You have to follow the same process for all of them, whether, you know, the guy is held for a serious offense or not. But the resources that are going to be needed for police officers to take time and either go to court or appear in the courthouse,
but doesn't
or,
when you're stopped
or,
by a police
or write up
officer,
the, or write the paperwork.
They ask for your ID. I mean, you're saying that they shouldn't ask them for their green card or any other proof of citizenship.
Can I just make
go ahead?
Can I just make one point here? Because as far as I'm concerned, most of this focus on quote illegal immigrants and the demonization of the illegal immigrant and oh my God, some of these people are committing crimes. The answer is sure they are, just like Native Americans are, but at a far lower rate. Pew studied this extensively, and what they found is that first generation immigrants were the least likely to commit crimes compared to Native born Americans.
It's not the real issue.
Trump ran on that, and the voters are unhappy about the presence of 11 million people in the country who are here illegally. I have personal friends who are in this country illegally. Doesn't matter. That's what he ran on. He has to enforce it. And the question is it all that hard to do this? And it doesn't seem like it is.
Since Reagan,
but we're talking sanctuary cities and whether governments can violate
federal law. When we come back, Adam is going to tell us a little bit more about what would happen if all federal funds dried up in Austin, Texas, or Los Angeles, or Chicago? We'll get to that specific when we come back. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through February, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts. Now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks for joining us. Let's go to Austin, Texas. Joe is listening to us on KLBJ. Go ahead, Joe.
Thanks, Bruce. Yeah, I don't understand what's so terrible about deporting, let's say, Mexicans back to Mexico. I mean, that's their native land. That's they speak the language. That's where they were born and raised. So many people act like deporting somebody back to Mexico is like a firing squad or throwing them over the cliff.
Well, one reason, Joe, is they came to the United States in search of a better life and a better fiscal situation for themselves because they cannot find that in Mexico. So they come to the United States in large numbers, and on a regular basis last year, $24 billion was sent back to Mexico. For all the Mexicans working in the United States.
And by the way, Bruce, there's a lot of Americans live in Mexico.
I know that.
I don't know if people know that.
I know that, yeah, sure.
They're all over the Riviera, right. In Mayan Riviera. Italy, they're all over the ports.
Italy,
they're all over inside Mexico,
right.
Creating companies, jobs, and enjoying the weather, enjoying the good life,
right.
Because their money's obviously.
But they do it legally in Mexico.
They do
it's
not.
It's very draconian
they do not
rules
legal,
about people
they,
there being
no,
illegally.
They travel to Mexico and stay in Mexico. How is that legally? The same is what the Mexicans
do they,
have done.
Do they pay taxes in Mexico?
Listen, that's a good question. If they're not legal, how are they paying taxes? But they're there. They're there.
Can I just want point out one thing about the deport? The caller's question specifically was, they're born in Mexico, they're raised in Mexico, what's wrong with deporting them back to Mexico? Well, a lot of the people who are being deported were not actually raised in Mexico. They came here, let's say, when they were young kids or they're teenagers. There was a story of a young woman who came here when she, I believe, was 9. Her crime that wound up getting her, she's in her 30s, she's got 2 teenage children who are not going to see their mother again because she was deported. Her crime was using a false social security number. Well, why did she use a false social security number? Because she was an undocumented immigrant. So for those who say, oh, well, he's only rounding up people who are committing these horrible, heinous crimes, that's nonsense. It's not actually what's happening.
Is that just Mexicans, by the way? Why is this whole thing on Mexicans? There's a lot of immigrants that are not just Mexicans.
Does a false identity or false social security card, does that allow that person to defraud the government in some way?
No, it makes them pay taxes.
No, you're paying taxes.
What about in benefits? What about in welfare benefits? What about in other services that are provided
by
states?
It's simply used so that the employer has a way to create a W-2 form and take withhold the taxes
that
they've got to pay.
Should all employers require some form of, automatic
registration.
We do.
They do it now.
But
it
isn't the law of the land yet.
Yeah, it is. Sure it is.
E-Verify.
It's an I-9.
E-Verify as well. They use the tools.
What percentage of employees in the United States require
A great majority of them now use E-Verify, and they use the W-9 identification that, let me see if you're legally legal to work in this company.
Thank you for your call, Joe. I want to get into a specific. If we were to pull federal funding from, let's say we're going to Chicago, if you've got Austin, Texas there, how much would Chicago lose?
So Chicago would lose its $5.3 billion in total in fiscal year 2016 that came from Washington, D.C. directly to the city of Chicago or its municipal agencies and entities, or came through on subgrants to the city. So a family of four, it's a little under $8,000 that would be a nullification tax by the mayor's policy. So if Trump was able constitutionally, and that's a huge question, the courts are really going to decide what the power of the purse is, what Trump's penalty that he can lever or Congress can lever on the sanctuary cities, but at risk in total, and we're proud that the national platform at ABC at NBC News cited our statistics and study and report on their report of what is a sanctuary city. So it's a significant amount of money, at least in play.
How much in Chicago? 5. What?
It's about $1,900 per man, woman, and child
total,
in the city.
Total. Total. The city.
You said 2.5.
5.3
billion.
I have it right here. So it's. It's 5.3 billion.
George, if we pulled $5.2 billion out of the coffers of Chicago, what would happen to this city?
Collapse.
Yeah, we would definitely not be in a good situation. But here, the point is, let's go back a second here. First of all, I think constitutionally is a problem. States' rights. I think from the states, even California and folks that are studying this now, we can find a mechanism to create a constitutional crisis between the states and the federal government. Because if you are not giving back the resources that come from the states and the money that flows to the Treasury,
yes.
I think there's a significant problem. So I think this is all a red herring. I mean, at the end of the day, I don't think he's going to have the power to withhold funds to cities or states. Whether they're blue, red, or green.
But there's an easy solution. You could just follow the notice requirement as put forth by Loretta Lynch, Department of Justice, in the summer of last year. That's it, and the whole issue goes away.
Politically, does Donald Trump have to make an example of someone, Michael Lotus?
I think he needs to keep his promise that he's going to deny funds or at least make some deal, negotiate with some mayor someplace, and show some progress on this. His voters, his supporters wanted them to do it.
So in our report, Miami had – they were one of the cities over 100,000 that had the least to lose per man, woman, and child in Miami, Florida. There was only $56 of federal funding at play.
And they reversed. They succumbed, yeah. Is there anybody else that has agreed to back off? Other than Miami, that's the only one that I've heard of. You know,
that's the only one I've heard of. That's the only city that I've heard that.
Does he have to make an example of somebody, Dave? And again, there will be ramifications. I mean, if you think a loss of $5 billion in Chicago, I mean, literally, it would destroy this city.
Well, just to put it in perspective, and the alderman can speak to this better than I can, but my recollection is that the entire budget of the city of Chicago is around $5.5 billion.
No, it's $8 billion. It's $8 billion, but I mean,
it's a little over $9 billion.
The city would continue to be run, obviously, because our funding comes from taxpayers, not from the federal government, but the grants for health
from federal taxpayers,
right? No, the tax base here provides for the services that are being provided
in the city.
The
federal money is provided
for transportation, correct.
Yeah.
But federal money is for transportation.
But from taxpayers. But
from taxpayers as well, correct.
But remember that in most cases, and you were alluding to this, the blue states and the blue cities provide far more revenue to the federal government correct. Than they get back from the federal government.
Well, let me
that's where the action's at, by the way. That's where the action's at.
Gentlemen, we've got to pause. 1-800-723-8289. When we come back...
That's what the action is.
We're going to be joined by Roger Stone. Don't go away.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications.
Hey everybody, this is Josh Groban. After so many years on the stage, one of my favorite things about music is its ability to inspire and nourish the soul. That's why I'm proud to work with Feeding America, an organization that inspires hope for families in need and helps nourish the 16 million kids in this country struggling with hunger. Every year, billions of pounds of excess food go to waste, while 1 in 5 children may be left not knowing where their next meal is coming from. or if it's even coming at all. Thankfully, the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks collects surplus food and helps deliver it to kids in need across the country. But they can't do it alone. Join me in supporting Feeding America and your local food bank at feedingamerica.org. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're Feeding America.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
There can be no stable and enduring peace without the participation of the People's Republic of China and its 750 million people. That is why I have undertaken initiatives in several areas to open the door for more normal relations between our two countries.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes, and you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to. Nope. I'm sure you've got a perfectly good excuse. Kids, work. I get it. You're busy. So what better time than now? Let's begin. Raise one finger if you're a man. Ladies, none yet. Oh, count in your head if you're driving. Now, three more fingers for everyone over 60, two over 50, one over 40, one more if you're not physically active, another finger if anyone in your family has type 2 diabetes, another if you've got high blood pressure. If you're overweight, raise another finger, two if you're very overweight, and three if you're really overweight. You've just taken the world's first audio prediabetes test. And if you're holding up five or more fingers, visit doihaveprediabetes.org or talk to your doctor. There's no excuse, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
We continue on Beyond the Beltway. I'm Bruce Dumont, live from Chicago. Thank you for joining us. In this segment of the broadcast, we are joined by Roger Stone, one of the country's leading political consultants, legendary political advisor, and author of a new book called The Making of the President 2016, and also a longtime friend of Donald Trump. And Mr. Stone, nice to have you with us on Beyond the Beltway.
Delighted to be with you.
When did you first hear that Donald Trump was planning to run for president?
Well, if you mean in the most recent cycle,
yes.
The president told me on New Year's Day 2013 that he was going to run for president. He also told me that within days of Mitt Romney being defeated, that Donald Trump went to the U.S. Trademarks and Patent Office and had trademarked the phrase, "Make America Great Again."
Wow.
And that's why I was convinced that he was quite serious, because, as you know, I had tried to get him to run for president in 2000 mm-hmm. as the Reform Party candidate. He had flirted with the idea in 2012, at the end of the day, rejecting a challenge to Mitt Romney. But as far as the most incredible upset in U.S. political history, it was New Year's Day 2013.
So there was no specific vacuum as it relates to issues or the way the public was reacting, other than there had been another Republican who lost the presidency and he saw somewhat of an open field before him.
He definitely found a race with no incumbent more attractive as well. Had he run in 2012, of course, he would have been challenging Barack Obama. Also, he would not have the political benefit of 8 years of the Obama presidency, mm-hmm. which I really think made 2016 the perfect storm, the ideal situation mm-hmm. for a populist uprising like the Trump campaign.
One aspect of the Donald Trump reputation politically to some, many of whom are African-American or liberals, was the role that he played in sort of leading and fanning the flames of the birther movement. In your conversations with him, did you discuss that matter? And was there a long-term political goal when he decided to lead that movement, which at least at one point was viewed as sort of a kooky movement. But again, it did take on a life of itself. Where did that idea of him leading it come from?
Well, first of all, Donald Trump is largely his own strategist.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an issue that he became interested in after reading about it on the internet, reading a book about it that he had read, I think, by Dr. Jerome Corsi. And he correctly sussed out that although the mainstream media didn't like to talk about it and really wouldn't cover the issue, there was probably at least half of the registered Republicans in the country who believed, for whatever reason, that Barack Obama was born abroad and therefore would have been constitutionally, ineligible to be president. What this demonstrates, I think, is Trump's ability to take an issue that was viewed as a fringe issue and make it a mainstream issue, to introduce it into a broader debate. Now, it's a very controversial issue, and it was certainly rarely discussed in 2016, but it did temporarily boost Donald Trump ahead of Mitt Romney in the Gallup polls in the run-up to 2012. Mm-hmm. I attribute that to his advocacy of the birther issue.
In the months leading up to his formal announcement from Trump Tower when he descended on the escalator, let's say in the 6 to 8 months prior to that, which was long after he shared his idea that he was running with you, how was he going about testing the issues that he was going to use in the campaign? What was there an extensive market testing that was going on, or was it his political gut, or were people like you and others feeding him information? How did he put that sort of that whole package together?
Well, first of all, Donald Trump is a man who has a voracious appetite for political information. That said, even I think he would admit that he is not terribly net savvy. But he reads an enormous amount about what was going on. The thing about Trump, unlike a career politician, is that he didn't take any polls whatsoever to determine what he should say or what issues he should be talking about. He didn't take any polls or focus groups, or there were no roundtables to discuss, the impact of the issues and whether they were too politically incorrect or not.
Mm-hmm.
Trump is his own man. He operates on gut instinct, and the issues that he has chosen, such as NATO and trade, are issues he's been talking about for 30 years. Immigration and our failed foreign policy seem to me to be pretty obvious, but he has three or four signature issues, which I believe could give him the opportunity to be one of our greatest presidents.
Make progress. Roger, I read somewhere several months ago that he was also a regular listener to a variety of talk radio programs, and that out of being a regular listener to some of the talk radio programs, that he decided that maybe the illegal immigration issue was really maybe the hottest of the hot button issues. Can you comment on that?
Well, it's certainly possible. Interestingly enough, I think this is the election in which the tipping point was finally reached, and the mainstream media monopoly on the dissemination of political information was broken. This is largely for technological reasons. Now that a majority of people are getting their news from their handheld device rather than a television set, lending itself a gateway, as it were, to the internet-based alternative media, now NBC, ABC, and CBS have to compete for listeners and viewers. And that, I think, is where, first of all, in talk radio, Donald Trump was very plugged into that community, big fan of Rush Limbaugh, big fan of Sean Hannity, guy who follows Newsmax, who follows Breitbart, who follows Infowars.com, somebody who has regularly watched the broadcasts of Alex Jones you know, Town Hall, the Daily Caller, Breitbart again. So I think he did get a lot of the themes and arguments, at least subconsciously, from this vibrant new alternative media.
One quick question, if you can answer it quickly. We've got 30 seconds before we break. In fact, you know, it's going to be unfair for me to ask the questions. I will wait until the next break. Let me mention that we're talking to Roger Stone. He's author of the book, The Making of the President, 2016. He's a close friend of the President of the United States, and we're hearing the story about how the phenomenon of 2016 unfolded. We'll take your telephone calls at 1-800-723-8029. Roger's in New York. We're in Chicago, and you're talking coast to coast on Beyond the Beltway. Back shortly from Chicago with Roger Stone, and our panel in Chicago will weigh in with some questions as well. Thanks for joining us tonight.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
Thank you all very much, Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans. Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Most of my family, they never graduated high school, so I'm trying to break that barrier.
My daughter, Brooklyn, was also a motivation for me to go back to school.
Every day after work, went straight to school, and it paid off.
At age 26, Kareem finished his high school diploma.
I could not have done it alone. I see the future is really bright for me.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, and Roger Stone joins us from New York, and also our panel in Chicago continues with us, and they'll be engaged in the conversation in just a few moments. But the question that I wanted to ask before the break to give you enough time to talk about it was, in the historic announcement when he came down the escalators at Trump Tower, obviously he delivered a fire and brimstone announcement speech unlike any president that I can recall ever announcing. In that speech, he talked about the Mexicans, the murderers, the rapists, and that Mexico is not sending us, you know, their very best. Had he not used that language, which has been described as inflammatory by so many since that announcement, would he have taken off? Was it the use of those terms? Was that what really grabbed his constituency?
I think you could certainly argue that that is the case. As you know, he was roundly condemned by the mainstream media.
Yes.
It is interesting that shortly thereafter, a woman is horrifically murdered in San Francisco by an illegal immigrant, and the issue really does shift to Trump very quickly. So, ironically, post-election conference at Harvard, Corey Lewandowski claimed that he had written Trump's announcement speech. Now, let me be clear. No one ever writes a Donald Trump speech but Donald Trump. And that was pure Donald Trump. I don't even think he was working from a text. He was working from, you know, handwritten notes.
Mm-hmm. But when you first heard it, and I don't know if you, I don't know whether you were there or you heard it on TV, but when you first heard it, was your reaction as a political, you know, consultant was, man, that is dynamic, or, oh, wait a minute, I think we may have just lost a lot of Hispanic votes by saying it the way you said it. How did you react from the moment you heard that phrase?
Internally, we had really come to the conclusion that Donald was right about the immigration issue, and that it could have enormous impact. So, and we weren't second-guessing the words chosen by our candidate. He made his point, and as you know, his candidacy did take off from that moment. This was a phenomena you had throughout the campaign, in which the candidate would say something. Those in the mainstream media and those steeped in conventional wisdom would say, oh, well, that's it for Trump. He's done.
Yes.
Trump would, in fact, go down a point or two in the polls, And then within days, he would float right back up to where he had been. Yeah.
Roger, you alluded.
The only thing I can attribute this to is the fact that the voters are looking at the big picture and they see these other little things as distractions. They want somebody who can halt the decline of the country.
Well, also, I think you alluded to it, but I this was something I said, during the campaign leading up to his election, and that is, he had history on his side, and he had world events and local events that he had no control over.
Correct.
On his side, he would say something, and then Kate Steinle would get murdered. He'd do something else, and San Bernardino would happen, or Orlando would happen, or the Brexit vote. I mean, it was this, as if he always was about 2 weeks ahead of some issue that was going to thrust his position on that issue, back into the forefront. And he was riding a wave that basically he had started with his rhetoric in some ways. Roger, we have someone here that I know is a longtime, supporter of Hillary Clinton and a Democrat and not someone that's been courteous to Donald Trump over the years. His name is Dave Lundy. He's a Democrat, but he has a question for you. Dave.
Thanks. Roger, I want to go back to something you said in the previous segment, because you talked about Donald Trump mainstreaming birtherism. And I'm just wondering, did he ever express any concerns that by mainstreaming and that by promoting it, he was essentially promoting a lie? Or did the president actually believe that Barack Obama was not born in the United States?
Yeah, the premise of your question. He couldn't know that he was promulgating a lie if he didn't believe it was a lie. At that point, it was an open question in his mind. He honestly didn't know.
So, that is my question. Did he you're saying that he actually had serious questions in his mind, despite all the evidence that had been produced to date, that Barack Obama was not born in the United States?
Well, but for what other reason would he raise the issue? He wouldn't give voice to this if he legitimately didn't know. So,
well, you said he was trying to run for president.
Yes, he had serious concerns about the question.
Roger, one other thing that has been said throughout this campaign, and that is Donald Trump, when he entered the race, he believed that he was going to be elected. Then there were those that suggested, no, that this was a conspiracy between he and Bill Clinton, and I think George Will promoted that idea. And then there was the thought that, he got in as sort of a lark, and then he started saying things, somewhat what's described as outrageous things by the media. And as you said, every time he said it, his polls would go up. And then suddenly, after about maybe 5 or 6 months, he started to believe that he really could be president. Do you think it took him that long to think that he really could win, or when did the reality of his electability, in your view, hit him and hit you?
Well, he was never running to lose. That was really the issue in both 2012 mm-hmm. and in 2000, because he made it abundantly clear to all of us that he had no interest in running if he didn't have a shot. He wasn't looking for a guarantee, because, of course, in politics, as in life, there are no guarantees. But I do think that he had a supreme confidence about 2016 that was unshakable from the beginning. He always believed that he would win. What surprised me really was days before the election, in an interview when he told a reporter that even he had succumbed to the drumbeat of mainstream media coverage saying over and over and over again that he couldn't win, that he wouldn't win, because he prepares his wife. He says to her, baby, when we may not win tonight. Even then, I believe that he held out hope in his heart that he was right, that he would win, and of course he did.
Michael Lotus is here. He was a Trump supporter long before it was fashionable. He's been a regular guest on this show for about a year and a half now. Michael, you've got a question.
Let me ask you a question about your book and what we might learn from it. And one thing in particular I'd like to know is, you've known Donald Trump a long time. You were kind of in on the fact that he was running. How did the campaign play out as far as, were you surprised? Did it go more or less as you thought? What were the kind of big surprises? What was the Just kind of your insight as someone who knew this was coming and how it played out.
Well, Donald Trump decided on a communications-based campaign for the Republican nomination, and he eschewed all of the traditional tools that we consider to be vital: polling, analytics, paid media, infrastructure, and so on. His campaign was based around a set of rallies that he would do in major media markets in the early primary states, because he was betting on the fact that CNN and Fox would afford these wall-to-wall coverage. These are like multi-million dollar campaign ads, as it were. And he did not have any of those other tools. He won the primaries in a walk going away using this model. So he was right about that. I was wrong about that. In the general election, he spent only $275 million, probably all told. That's between Trump and the various independent groups. Compared that with what has to be approaching $2 billion for Hillary Clinton. And the fact that Google and Facebook are playing with their logarithms to disadvantage him. And the fact that Fox and CNN, CNN, and in the general election sometimes Fox, are unloading every day invective and attack media on him. What's that worth from a commercial point of view? It's amazing the array of forces that Trump took on and prevailed. It really is amazing.
Were you surprised it worked?
No, I really wasn't. I thought that it could work. I really did think that by retargeting the silent majority, by giving voice to the forgotten Americans, that he could, in a handful of states, pull in white moderate Democrats who had voted for Obama, who had voted for Clinton, but who were finally soured on the Democratic Party.
Roger, Donald Trump in this campaign spent more time talking to, reaching out allegedly, at least with his rhetoric, to African Americans. Maybe he didn't spend as much time in those communities as some African Americans would like. But again, taking the issue of Chicago, taking the issue of crime and safety and education and aspirations for African Americans, spent more time talking about it than any Republican that I can ever remember running for President of the United States. He's done it a couple of times since he has been elected President of the United States. How important is that message? And is it a message that he truly believes, or is it one that has some political expediency to it?
I actually think it's one of the most important opportunities that he has. I believe he could affect an entire political realignment by reaching out to our inner cities with a real program for economic salvation and reaching out to
Do you have time to stick by with one more segment?
Sure, I'll stick with
Okay, very good. I want you to follow up on that when we continue. 1-800-723-8029 if you have questions for Roger Stone. And again, we do have some questions coming in from El Paso, Texas, and we'll take those when we come back.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight, we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair. See Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
The biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We're talking with Roger Stone in New York City. He is author of the new book, The Making of the President, 2016. It's a hot new bestseller that's out on the market, and Roger is sharing some time with us this evening. Roger, we got calls in El Paso, Texas. Jorge is listening to us on KTSM. Go ahead, El Paso. You're on the air with Roger Stone and the rest of our group.
Roger, I want to ask you, because I'm an ardent supporter of the president, if I might not be mistaken in my support of him. I believe in him because of his political philosophy, where I sense that he believes that the individual of government is of crucial significance in government. If I'm not mistaken in believing that of him, and if that's the case, if that is his philosophy, as I've understood him to say it so, where would he have got this philosophy from other than perhaps the broad radio programs that you mentioned he listens to?
From what programs? I didn't hear you. From what programs?
His philosophy. What did he get his
Where did he get his philosophy from? Where do you think he got his philosophy from, Roger?
Well, I don't think he's a conservative ideologue. I think he is a kind of a populist with conservative tendencies. I think that he has gotten his philosophy over the years by reading and following the news and following some of these issues. The decline of America is not hard to see. It's not hard to find, and it's not hard to figure out why we are trending in that direction. So, again, I don't think that he is, he would tell you he's not a pure conservative, but on the five or six major issues that I think mattered to conservatives and conservative voters in 2016, he was perfectly positioned on those issues.
During the campaign, thank you very much, caller. During the campaign, every time he would say something that the mainstream media thought was outrageous, political people sitting around the tables in Washington, D.C. was, well, that's it. That's going to sink him. Was there any time during the campaign that he said something that you, as this rich and respected political operative, said to yourself, oh, my God, he may have gone over the edge with this statement?
Well, my wife would probably disagree with you on the rich part. I'm not stupid enough to answer that question. There were occasions in the campaign, of course, where he could have worded things differently. But the thing I don't think people understand is that, unlike working for Ronald Reagan or unlike working for Richard Nixon, who were political animals and who were more built around a Machiavellian model, what you see is what you get. Trump is just blunt, and he's genuine, and he's authentic, and it's not scripted by someone else, some speechwriter or some researcher. What, you know, Trump is the captain of his own ship. He is his own strategist. He is his own best speechwriter. He has, a unique understanding of the mass media. It has made him an international celebrity long before he was in politics. Mm-hmm. So this whole idea that he's going to become more presidential, that's not the Donald Trump people voted for. This is the Trump they voted for. And if he makes progress on the major issues, revitalizes the economy, seals the border, gets us a better immigration system, renegotiates these trade deals, bringing jobs back in the country, nobody will care about his, you know, Twitter feeds and his eccentricities or his tendencies. Every one of our presidents has gone through this period. They said Andrew Jackson was crude and ignorant, a bumpkin. They said that Theodore Roosevelt was an egomaniac who told enormous lies. Two of our greatest presidents. So those who would judge Donald Trump after roughly 4 weeks as president, they may be a little quick on the punch.
Yesterday in Melbourne, Florida, he said that basically he's running again. So my question to you would be, how important is a continuing bashing of the press? How important is that to his appeal, and how important is it to his reelection effort?
Well, this is where he has, of course, stolen a page from my mentor, President Nixon. As I mentioned in my book, The Making of the President 2016, it was Nixon who first foresaw the possibility of a Trump presidency. It is. Ask me your question again. I'm sorry, I got to the.
Well, I'm going to ask you a different question. I'm going to ask you the question I asked you before the break, and that is, you were starting to make the point about the outreach to the African American community and how pivotal that might be politically down the road.
Yeah, this is a golden opportunity, largely because of the 1994 crime bill, which incarcerated an entire generation of young black men for the nonviolent crime of possession of small amounts of drugs. There was not much appeal for Hillary Clinton to African-American voters. Donald Trump got only 3% more of that vote than Mitt Romney. But as you'll read in my book, that 3% is pivotal. That 3% gives you Michigan. That 3% gives you, because of the vote in Milwaukee, it gives you Wisconsin. Also, African-American turnout across the board was down from the historic levels, as you might expect, that it had hit under Barack Obama. So you have a number of African-Americans realizing after a long period of time that the Democratic Party takes their votes but delivers nothing other than welfare checks, and that's not what they want. They want a piece of the American pie. They want to be, you know, they want to be store owners, not store employees.
They want
prosperity for themselves and their families. They want good schools. They want safe neighborhoods. If Donald Trump can use the free enterprise spark to rejuvenate those communities through a series of tax reductions and other strategies and get opportunity back into those places, you could have a historic realignment.
Roger, I have been told by someone who is allegedly, they are very close to senior White House strategists who have said to me that in talking about this very issue, that their goal in the next 4 years is to double the African-American vote. And if they can do that, they think they could literally run the Democratic Party out of business. Have you heard that? Do you believe that? Does that make sense to you?
It makes enormous sense to me. It's a historic opportunity. This has to be seen historically. Until 1932, or I should say until 1936, a majority of African-Americans voted Republican. More African-Americans voted for Herbert Hoover than Franklin Roosevelt. This changes in 1960 with the election of John Kennedy. And then the Lyndon Johnson welfare state locks black voters into the Democratic Party until the present day. Yet their communities are among the most oppressed. Their schools are the worst. Their job opportunities are the least. And I think Donald Trump totally sees this and is totally focused on making his move here to, you know, have a major cultural and political realignment in the country.
George Cardenas joins us. He is an alderman in the city of Chicago representing the 12th Ward, and he has a question for you, Roger.
Roger, I have not read your book. I will do that. I want to talk about the president's narcissistic personality and its impact in the White House and on his policy decisions, obviously, and more importantly, on the new dynamics, obviously, that we have now with technology and in the instant reality TV show that is being run out of the White House. What is that impact? Are people going to get tired of that pretty soon? And I know he wants to be loved. That's something that Howard Stern said, because obviously he knows him. He's had him on his show many times. And this protest that we have around the country, will that have an impact on him psychologically?
Well, I think, you know, you have to be a narcissist to be in politics, even to run for, say, city alderman.
Whoa.
I believe they accused Theodore Roosevelt of being a narcissist. One
We're
of
the
our
good
greatest
guys.
Presidents. The reality show that you say is coming out of the White House, you're right about one thing, and that is people see the coverage of television as seamless. They often don't distinguish between entertainment and information, although I guess I would call CNN infotainment in any event. I think that actually 15 seasons of The Apprentice made people more comfortable with the leadership qualities of Donald Trump. Think about the way he looks visually. His visuals are everything. The lighting, the high back chair, is red power tie. I know elitists can scoff at this, but it's interesting that the last season had an audience that was only slightly less than the first season. In television, for 15 seasons, that's almost unknown. The trend line is always down until they cancel you. So I hope that addresses your question.
It does. And I also think the point is that I, again, send this for, you know, ever since he announced, what people saw year after year, they saw a guy sit down and take charge. He had people around him. You know, I think they would like to see the cabinet meeting run that way. Okay, if you're doing a bad job, General Flynn, you're fired, whatever the case may be. I think that's what the American people fell in love with, you know, for all these seasons on television. So listen, Roger, we are out of time. The title of the book is The Making of the President, 2016. I thank you very much for being with us. And in your next conversation with the president, I hope you will remind him that there's a program called Beyond the Beltway. It's been on for 37 years. We do the show one block from Trump Tower in Chicago, and I hope that he will be a guest and maybe even with you some in some future broadcast. But thank you very much for being with us tonight on Beyond the Beltway.
Had a great time. Thank you very much.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through February, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
And you can't get one to replace it.
Come on back in Chicago.
And it was infected.
Tom in Youngstown, Ohio, listening to us on WKBN. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. Good evening, Bruce, and your guest. Before Roger Stone was on, Bruce, you were talking about sanctuary cities.
Yes.
And your panelists seem to indicate that the illegals had legitimate Social Security cards. You had a caller last week who was a detective who was working out of the Chicago area,
yes,
who said that a lot of these illegals have fraudulent Social Security cards. They create income tax problems and credit,
right,
problems for a lot of citizens of the United States. And going beyond that, I think that the illegals here artificially keep the price of labor down in wages down in some industries, in addition to the fact that they, we have a lot of people on unemployment or welfare who maybe, even though they don't want to work those jobs, they should be working those jobs.
And like Adam and George both have comments. Adam?
Well, the caller, he cites legitimate concern. As a matter of fact, our organization at OpenTheBooks.com asked the IRS why they spent $11 million on guns, ammunition, and military-style equipment over the course of a seven-year period. And here was the response. 20% of IRS law enforcement can be related to the increase in recent identity theft crimes and the prosecution of those crimes into sophisticated gang activity. So it's a legitimate concern from the caller.
It is, but they're not talking about immigrants. They're talking about folks that are stealing your identity. These are criminals. Very, very well versed in cyber.
But you're not saying they couldn't be.
I'm not saying they couldn't be, but I'm just saying the sophisticated fraudsters have the tools. These are immigrants that potentially that may have a social security number they're using. They may borrow from a relative per se. But these are crimes that I think are solvable. And
but you don't believe they should be deportable. if someone is defrauding the government with an illegal ID, Social Security, whatever it is, if they're defrauding the government, in your view, is that a deportable offense?
Look, I think anybody defrauding the government, especially in this circumstance, should pay a price, right?
Deportable, George, should they be deported?
They should be deported.
Well, the mayor says no. He says that violates the welcoming spirit of the city.
If they are found to have
defrauded the government.
If they are found to have defrauded the government,
yes,
in a legal case, then absolutely.
But if they're using that Social Security number and paying taxes on that Social Security number, which is more often what is the case,
yes,
these people are trying to fit into our society, and so they are having Social Security numbers because you have to in order to get a job, then where is the fraud other than the fraudulent number in the first place? In other words, the way you ask the question suggests that by having that number, they're depriving the government of something when, in fact, they're enhancing. They're giving the government something that they wouldn't otherwise
but
have.
But the case I'm talking about is someone comes to the country illegally.
Yes.
They then get a Social Security card, which is phony, illegally. So they've done two illegal things in the United States.
So you would rather they didn't have a Social Security card and didn't work?
Let me finish. If they are stopped and if they are asked to say, okay, are you a good citizen of the country, what is the answer? They've committed two laws.
Look, I think the government...
They're not speeding. They didn't have their taillight out. They didn't murder anybody. They didn't rape anybody.
The premise of the government, and this is the IRS, is for you to pay taxes. So if you're paying taxes, that's what they care about. They're not checking immigration status on you when you're reporting those wages over where they come from. They have the technology to know if this person is valid or not valid or if there's any inconsistencies. But if you're paying your taxes, the IRS is going to leave you alone. They have, obviously, for many years. Otherwise, this should have been stopped. Since the beginning.
Do you agree with that? If someone comes
no,
to
I mean federal laws need to be enforced or you politically change the law.
If
and
you
especially
are,
for no, law enforcement here's what they're I'm, supposed to enforce
here's my,
the law
my question.
Very simply.
If someone comes here and they are paying taxes and they have a Social Security card, let's say it's a phony Social Security card. Is it phony with the government? Does the Social Security Administration know that that's a phony card? Could somebody be paying taxes on a phony card, and should they be getting benefits back if they're putting benefits in?
Well, they're paying into the system.
But they should get their money back then. Okay, they should get something
the
back.
Government allows.
So let me ask you a question.
Illegally, and they've stolen an identity, which is a false Social Security card, and so I mean I'm just mystified as the
there's
questions.
People that stealing identities.
If they're picked up, the local law enforcement has to notice the feds. That's the law. That's what a sanctuary city and a mayor is preventing.
A lot of this conversation, I think, is two groups of people talking past each other. If you talk to people who have a pretty sophisticated knowledge about this, they'll tell you there's many millions of people who are in the country illegally but who are paying taxes. They're paying into the system. They're not bad people doing bad things.
Right.
And I don't think most people disagree with that. Okay. Now, if someone comes in, they commit a crime, they shouldn't be in the country in the first place. They should be sent back where they belong. Let me finish. Most people don't disagree with that. This is really not a money issue. There's all kinds of issues in politics that are about the money. This is an identity issue. Is there one set of rules that gets enforced and other people don't have to live by it? Do we secure our border? Do we decide as a community by our votes and our laws who comes into our country, who lives here or not? And so the question is, how do you work this out in a way that's going to be fair? But people want to feel like the people they elect and the laws that get passed apply, and we control who is in our country.
George, let me ask you a question. The Hispanics that you represent in the 12th Ward, what percentage of them do you feel are either Trump voters, potential Trump voters, or they are immigrants who came to this country and they are as ticked off with illegal immigration as someone elsewhere in the city?
I think constituencies here in the city, not just mine, are ticked off to the fact that nothing's getting done. They're ticked off that their jobs are going overseas, and they're ticked off that the education system is not working for them. They're ticked off that the city, the state, is a dysfunctional state. Those are the things that they care about. But immigration, illegal immigration, is not something that they come out and say, gee, I wish you would fix the problem. that is, you know, so huge for our society.
So they're not upset with illegal immigration?
Oh, there's some that are upset with people not following the rules.
We got to pause. We're out of time for the entire broadcast. George Cardenas, Adam Andrzejewski, Dave Lundy, Michael Lotus, thanks very much. I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago. The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications.
Hey, everybody, this is Josh Groban. After so many years on the stage, one of my favorite things about music is its ability to inspire and nourish the soul. That's why I'm proud to work with Feeding America, an organization that inspires hope for families in need and helps nourish the 16 million kids in this country struggling with hunger. Every year, billions of pounds of excess food go to waste, while one in five children may be left not knowing where their next meal is coming from, or if it's even coming at all. Thankfully, the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks collects surplus food and helps deliver it to kids in need across the country. But they can't do it alone. Join me in supporting Feeding America and your local food bank at feedingamerica.org. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're Feeding America.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
There can be no stable and enduring peace without the participation of the People's Republic of China and its 750 million people. That is why I have undertaken initiatives in several areas to open the door for more normal relations between our two countries.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes, and you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to. Nope. I'm sure you've got a perfectly good excuse. Kids, work. I get it. You're busy. So what better time than now? Let's begin. Raise one finger if you're a man. Ladies, none yet. Oh, count in your head if you're driving. Now, three more fingers for everyone over 60, two over 50, one over 40, one more if you're not physically active, another finger if anyone in your family has type 2 diabetes, another if you've got high blood pressure. If you're overweight, raise another finger. Two if you're very overweight. And three if you're really overweight. You've just taken the world's first audio prediabetes test. And if you're holding up five or more fingers, visit doihaveprediabetes.org or talk to your doctor. There's no excuse, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.